Late in the evening, on November 28, 1563, a young woman, well-dressed, her head covered, with a bundle in her arms, sneaked out of the front door of a family's house. An older, simpler-dressed woman, also with a bundle in her arms, followed. She pushed the door closed. The two women hurried over a crooked bridge and entered a door in a palace on the opposite side. After a while, they came out again, now in the company of a well-dressed young man. The three, half running, returned over the bridge. They didn't enter the palace the women came from, but a small house besides it. Sometime later, an elderly man came out of that modest house and started preparing the boat moored near the bridge. He then went back to the house, called inside, and the young couple came out quickly, stepped into the boat, and the old man rowed them down the dark canal. Bianca Cabello, the young woman, 17 years of age at her elopement, would never come back to Venice again. She would, however, become Grand Duchess of Tuscany. Welcome to the Venetian Stories podcast. I'm René Sandale, and I'll be your guide on this journey. Episode 10, Bianca Cabello, Part 1. Who was Bianca Cabello? In the Venetian Republic of the 1500s, like in most Renaissance societies, many aspects of a person's life were decided by their birth. To place Bianca Cabello, we must therefore start with her family. The Cabello family was one of the Case Nuove, the new houses of the Venetian aristocracy. The first notable figure in the family was Vettore Cabello, lived 1400 to 1467, who rose to the role of Capitan da Mar, the highest admiral in the Venetian navy. Bianca's father was Bartolomeo Cabello, born in 1519. He had a quite honorable political career for a Venetian nobleman. He served in the Quarantia, the Court of Appeals, as Proveditore sopra I Dazi, customs revenue, Proveditore alla Sanità, superintendent of public health, and in the Ragion Nuove, auditors of mostly military expenditure. He also served in the Venetian Senate, the Pregati, and a three-year term as Podestà di Treviso, governor of the mainland city of Treviso, a period which coincided with the severe plague epidemic of 1575-77. His career ground to a halt in 1579 due to the actions of his daughter. Bartolomeo married Pellegrina Morosini in 1544. The Morosini family was one of the most ancient noble families of Venice, so it was an excellent connection. Pellegrina gave birth to Bianca in 1546, and to her brother Vettore the year after. She died when the children were small, but we don't know the exact year. What we do know is that Bartolomeo remarried in 1559 to Lucrezia Grimani, the widow of Andrea Contarini. She was the granddaughter of Doge Antonio Grimani, born 1434, elected Doge 1521, died 1523, and the sister of Giovanni Grimani, the Patriarch of Aquileia, comparable to an archbishop. This second marriage was an advancement for Bartolomeo, socially, politically, and economically, because the Grimani were a very influential and wealthy family. Lucrezia, however, was a severe stepmother to the two children. Bianca, months later, in a letter to her cousin Andrea, ascribed her elopement to the way her stepmother treated her. The young man was not who Bianca initially had believed him to be. He was Piero Bonaventuri, a Florentine, son of Zenobio Bonaventuri. The Bonaventuri had a noble past in Florence, but their waning fortunes had seen them drop out of the Florentine aristocracy. They still had useful connections, though. In Venice, Piero worked for his paternal uncle, Giambattista Bonaventuri, who worked as a moneylender at the Rialto Market. Modern banking has its roots amongst moneylenders in Florence and Venice in the 1400s and 1500s. Each moneylender had a desk or a counter, literally a banco, under a portico at the marketplace, from where they ran their business. Many of our banking terms, such as bank, account, credit, debit, are early Italian words from this period in Florence and Venice. The two cities were some of the most important commercial and financial markets in Europe, and there were close economic ties between them. Giambattista Bonaventuri managed the money lending affairs in Venice for the wealthy Florentine Salviati family and employed his nephew there. They operated the Banco Salviati. The young Piero liked to dress and live well, often above his means, and would often pretend to be a Salviati rather than a Bonaventuri. The Capello Palace was surrounded on three sides by canals. From the land side back door, a crooked bridge crossed the now filled-in canal of Rio di Santa Ponal. Across that bridge was the house Giambattista Bonaventuri had rented as their residence in Venice. The windows of Bianca's rooms in one building and those of Piero's rooms in the other building were just in front of each other on opposite sides of the canal. Bianca was being kept secluded by her stepmother, but the two passed messages back and forth, then started seeing each other secretly when their parents were out of the way. The only one in on the secret relationship was Bianca's trusted maid. It appears that Bianca initially believed Piero to be one of the wealthy Salviati family, and in that case, she could probably have obtained her father's consent to a marriage. Piero was not, however, a Salviati, but a much poorer and lower-ranked Bonaventuri. Bianca was a Venetian noblewoman, with a maternal inheritance of 6,000 scudi and more to come later from her father. He was not a suitable match for Bianca, and the chances of getting a paternal consent were much lower. The consequences for the young lovers were dire if they couldn't marry. Seducing a young noblewoman could land Piero in prison, sentenced to a huge fine, or worse, see him dead at the hands of Bartolomeo Capello himself or somebody for him. Those were matters of family honor. For Bianca, it would mean a secluded life in a convent. Confronted with such prospects, the two ran for it. Bianca gathered her jewels and other valuables she had and convinced the boatman of the Capello family to row them to Fusina on the mainland. The couple arrived on the mainland and immediately headed south as fast as they could. they crossed the border on the Adige River the next day. They were then in the Papal State, where the Venetian authorities couldn't reach them. The expectation was, however, that Bianca's father would have hired armed men to pursue them, with orders to kill Piero and bring back Bianca, destined for a nunnery for the rest of her life. The two continued to Ferrara, Bologna, across the Apennines, and after 4 days on the road, they arrived at the city gates of Piero's native Florence. They went directly to his family, who lived in the Piazza San Marco of all places. Zenobio Bonaventuri welcomed his son back, accepted that he had dragged Bianca along, but forbade them to leave the house. The expectation was still that armed men would come for them. On December 12th, 1563, the two were married in the nearby church of San Marco. When the disappearance of Bianca was discovered in the morning of November 29th, it didn't take long to connect it to the disappearance of the young man in the palace across the canal. Interrogated, the maid and the boatman told what had happened during the night. However, Bartolomeo didn't hire thugs to pursue the couple. We can only speculate as to why, but maybe it was just simple economics. Bianca was damaged goods. A marriage for her in Venice would be much under their social level and hence not acceptable. And a monastery would require her dowry, so at least a part of those 6,000 scudi Pellegrina Morosini had left her daughter. If Bianca just stayed put in Florence, she would soon be forgotten and the money would remain in the family. There would be little to gain and something to lose by dragging her back. What Bartolomeo did to protect his honor and reputation was to bring the issue up in front of the Council of Ten. The Council of Ten handled state security. It was a secret police, and it was the tribunal for criminal cases which involved nobles. On December 10th, the Council of Ten decided to put a reward for Piero's capture or death. Both Bartolomeo and the Patriarch of Aquileia added to that reward, but none of them did anything actively. On the 15th, Giambattista Bonaventuri was arrested as an accomplice of his nephew. Not exactly a young man, he died 2 months later in prison of some kind of disease, probably due to the awful conditions. Both the Capello family and the Republic did little to recover Bianca. Over the next few years, the Republic made some requests to the Duke of Florence to send her back, but they were declined and nothing further happened. Bianca's life with the Bonaventuri in Florence wasn't as easy as she had contemplated. The Bonaventuri were far less affluent than the Capello family in Venice. And Bianca had to contend with a much simpler life. There were far fewer servants, and Bianca had to partake directly in the household chores, something she had never had to do before. Nevertheless, the year 1564 proved eventful for Bianca and her new family. She was pregnant because in October she gave birth to hers and Piero's daughter Pellegrina, named after Bianca's mother. The timing implies that she was pregnant when the two eloped from Venice, but she probably didn't know it yet. As the threat from Venice didn't seem to materialize, she gradually emerged from hiding. Rumors of the beautiful young Venetian noblewoman hiding in Florence had abounded from the time of her arrival, so she received her fair share of attention. One day, she caught the eye of the young Francesco de' Medici, son and heir to Cosimo I, Duke of Florence, and they started seeing each other. In October, shortly before the birth of Pellegrina, Zenobio Bonaventuri asked to be officially relieved of his legal responsibilities for his daughter-in-law, which indicates that already then things were well out of his control. So within 1 year, while on the run from the law of Venice, newlywed and pregnant, she became the mistress of the heir and regent of the Duchy of Florence. Francesco de' Medici was the oldest son of Cosimo I de' Medici, who had ascended to the ducal throne in 1537 at the age of 17. The year 1564 turned out quite eventful for him too, and not just because of Bianca. His father, Cosimo, had married a Spanish princess, Eleonora of Toledo, who gave him 11 children. Three children died very young, which was not unusual, but it wasn't the end of it. In 1557, Maria died, age 17. In 1561, Lucrezia died, age 16. And in 1562, within 1 month, he lost Giovanni, age 19, Garcia, age 15, and his wife, age 40, all to malaria. Consequently, in June 1564, Cosimo decided to retire from government and left the day-to-day business of the Duchy of Florence to Francesco. Cosimo retained the title and continued to engage in foreign relations, but otherwise didn't interfere much in his son's administration. At this point, the family of Francesco consisted of his father, his sister Isabella, married to the Duke of Bracciano in the Papal State, his brother Ferdinando, who was a cardinal in Rome, and another younger brother, Pietro. It was now paramount that Francesco got an heir, and hence a dynastically interesting wife. The choice fell on the Habsburg princess Johanna of Austria, daughter of Ferdinand I of Austria. Treaties were drawn up, dowries and gifts decided, and in March 1565 the marriage was announced. Johanna, or Giovanna as she is called in Italy, arrived in Tuscany in December, and the wedding celebrations occupied the whole city for weeks on end. Giovanna of Austria would have an important, if unwanted, role in Bianca's life. If she was just the right woman for Francesco in terms of dynastic connections, she wasn't in terms of personal chemistry. Giovanna was very religious and pious, rather skinny, not very pretty, with the classical Habsburg lower jaw. In short, as a person, she was the exact opposite of Bianca. Of course, such a thing is never said, much less written, but it is evident that for Francesco, the only purpose of Giovanna was a dynastic bond with an important European power, and that she should produce a male heir. While the former worked out okay, the second didn't really. Of the 8 children she bore Francesco in the 12 years of their loveless marriage, the first 6 were girls, of which only 2 lived into adulthood. People in the past buried plenty of children, even among the wealthy and powerful elite. While Giovanna was popular with the common people of Florence, she never became a Florentine. She lived much of her life in Florence, secluded in the Pitti Palace, surrounded by German-speaking servants and ladies-in-waiting, which she had brought with her from Austria. She never really learned the Tuscan language, and she apparently never really tried. So, Francesco married Giovanna, but for love, affection, confidentiality, he turned to Bianca. Bianca was married, so her husband Pietro Bonaventuri had to be kept quiet. She also lived in the house of her in-laws, which was awkward. Already in 1565, Pietro had received a position at court with a decent stipend in the wardrobe of the palace. Besides paying him off, it gave him social standing in the city, and it made it plausible for both him and Bianca to come and go at the palace. In either 1566 or 1567, Pietro bought a house he absolutely couldn't afford for Bianca. Located in the Via Maggio, just a few hundred meters from the Pitti Palace, it was painted in fantastic black and white designs with the Cappello coat of arms over the main entrance. Her apartment was on the first floor, while Pietro's was on the ground floor with a separate entrance. Francesco had the keys, came and went as he pleased, which was, from what we can gather, practically daily. His public life was in the palace, but his private life was in Via Maggio. In 1567, Francesco gifted Bianca a large agricultural estate outside of the city, so she could be economically independent and able to run a proper household. Bianca's life as the mistress of the prince was thus fairly settled. A few years forward, the year 1570 started well with Cosimo I crowned Grand Duke of Tuscany by the Pope. That was a title which placed the rulers of Florence and Tuscany higher than the rulers of most of the other small Italian states, such as the duchies of Parma, Modena, Ferrara, Mantua, and Piedmont. However, somehow the half-public knowledge of Francesco's private life with Bianca, his constant comings and goings at all times of day and night in the Via Maggio, made it into the German-speaking bubble around Giovanna. Giovanna had an absolute hissy fit. Now, what Giovanna felt was not in itself a problem. There was little she could do, unless her sentiments made it their way back to her imperial family in Austria. The danger wasn't what Giovanna could or couldn't do, but what Austria would do. Austria here being her father. Such a marriage wasn't as much between two persons as it was between two states. Francesco had to appease Giovanna, so he promised her not to see Bianca anymore. And they went on a long journey around Tuscany together so she could see her lands. Bianca had already left Florence for one of her villas in the countryside. More gifts and the regular income from her estates had made her even wealthier, and materially she was probably richer than her family back in Venice. After the return of Francesco and Giovanna to Florence, Giovanna gave birth to their fourth daughter, who died within a year. Francesco and Bianca soon picked up where they left, but kept a lower profile. That lower profile was put at risk by the antics of Pietro Bonaventuri. While he had in many ways a good life, a position at court, a secure income, social standing thanks to its closeness to the ducal household, having your life and status depend on who your wife sleeps with wasn't exactly honorable. He started having mistresses of his own and had an affair, entirely in the open, with Caterina Ricci, a widow from an important Florentine family. The Ricci family was rich, powerful, well-connected, and they had already dispatched three of Caterina's previous lovers across the River Styx. That proved a bit harder with Piero, due to his connections to the ducal household and through Bianca to the prince himself. The Ricci family tried several times to bring up their grievance with the Medici, directly to Francesco and through his sister Isabella, but to little avail. Francesco pleaded with Bianca to stop Piero, but despite all the warnings, he persisted in seeing Caterina publicly. Her family then went directly to Francesco, who in late August 1572 left Florence for a hunting trip in one of the many ducal villas around. As soon as Francesco was out of town, the Ricci family mustered a group of 12 men who secretly followed Piero to see his mistress and then rounded him up under Bianca's house where they attacked him. Piero defended himself and wounded several of the assailants, but ended up dead in a pool of blood. As the neighbors sounded the alarm, Bianca came out and found her dead husband on her doorstep. She had the body moved directly to the nearby church, where it was ready for a funeral the following morning. That was today's episode of Venetian Stories. Thank you for traveling with me. The next episode will land whenever I have time to record it, but if all goes well, within a couple of weeks. If you happen to come to Venice, come join one of my tours about the history of Venice. You can find them at historywalksvenice.com.